My name is Vince Vitkowski. I'm a partner at Edwards Angel Palmer & Dodge. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, welcome to our symposium on cybersecurity, national security, and economic security. The symposium is being sponsored by the International National Security Group of the Practice Group of the Federalist Society. Now, as the people in this room already know, cybersecurity poses some of the most significant political and economic challenges of the 21st century. What we're all a little less clear on is how to most effectively meet those challenges. It's an ongoing process, and in some sense, we're all present at the creation in this area. So this is our century, our generation, I guess. Now, the concept of itself is hard to define. I went through the exercise. I probably missed something. There's cyber warfare, cyber terrorism, cyber exploitation, which may or may not be cyber espionage, both government to government and private. Cyber attacks on private companies, including those in the critical infrastructure technologies, cyber theft of personal data. And I probably missed something. To help us think about these issues, we have a very capable panel, and I'm simply going to introduce the moderator of that panel, and he'll take it from there. Moderator known to many, I'm sure most of you are known to each other, Paul Rosenzweig. Paul is the principal in Red Branch Consulting, which is a Homeland Security consulting firm. Before that, he was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Right now, he's a physically visiting fellow at the Medill School for Journalism at Northwestern, who's writing a book on cyber warfare. He's previously co-authored a book with James Carafano called Winning the Long War, Lessons from the Cold War for Defeating Terrorism and Preserving Freedom.
Thank you. So,
thank you all for coming. Thanks, Steptoe and Johnson, for this marvelous facility. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, man. It's very good to be here. It's a great pleasure to participate in this Federalist Society event about an issue that has come, I think, to dominate a lot of the news today. If anybody has been, you know, reading the papers for the last just 2 weeks, you've seen hacks of things as significant as the CIA's website by groups of what look to be, you know, just kids, though they go by the name LulzSec, Lulz being the cyber word for laughter. So the question before us today is how significant is this threat? What aspects of cyber security are national security issues? There are many issue parts of it that are probably not, that are likely economic security issues for the second panel. But the panel today, we're going to focus on this from the perspective of governmental interest in national security. I am very happy to be joined by four distinguished panelists, who I will introduce in a second. Our method for the first panel, we're going to try and do this slightly differently, and instead of the traditional boring, everybody gives a 10-minute speech, and then we all kind of look at each other, we're going to try and then let you get to questions. We're going to try and do a more interactive method. I have a list of some of the big think questions, and each I'll ask them of the panelists, each of the ones I call, and I'll give 2, 3, 4 minutes on the topic. Then the other panelists will react. We'll do some of those, and then towards the end of the day, end of the panel, we have till what, 11:30, Vince? Before we get to the end of this panel, we'll turn it over to you for some more questions. So rather than just canned speeches, I hope we'll actually develop some thoughtful analysis of this. So let me introduce all four of the panelists before diving in. And I'll start at the far end and work my way this way. Farthest away from me is Steve Bradbury. Steve is a partner at the office of Deckard LLP, where he does general litigation and constitutional law and appellate matters. More significantly for our purposes, from April 2004 until January 2009, he was at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he was the Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, or OLC. He was acting AAG there from 2005 to 2007, and he was the presidential nominee in charge of the office from 2005 to 2009. He's a graduate of Stanford University and has his JD from the University of Michigan Law School. He clerked for Judge James L. Buckley of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and Clarence Thomas of the Supreme Court. Next to him is Colonel Gary Brown. Colonel Brown is the senior legal advisor for U.S. Cyber Command, the new military command at Fort Meade, Maryland. Cyber Command is responsible, as I'm sure most of you know, for operating the defense of DoD networks and plans and conducts other cyber activities, notably offensive cyber activities, when and if authorized. He received his law degree from the University of Nebraska and an LLM in international law from Cambridge University, no slouch he. Before coming to Cyber Command, he was the senior legal counsel to the Air Component Commander in Southwest Asia. That is, he was directing, offering legal advice on air operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. Next is Shane Harris. Shane is the non-lawyer on the panel. He is, however, an award-winning author and magazine journalist. He wrote what I think is a truly excellent book about data mining and cyber issues called The Watchers, which tells the story of five men who played central roles in some of the controversial national security programs that happened in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. That book won the New York Public Library's Helen Bernstein Book Award for excellence. He is currently a senior writer at Washingtonian Magazine, and his work regularly appears in places as diverse as The Wall Street Journal, Slate, The Daily Beast, which is my favorite, The Atlantic, and National Journal and Washington Post. Finally, immediately to my right is Professor Jeremy Rapkin. Jeremy is a professor of law at George Mason University School of Law. Before joining that faculty in 2007, he was for 27 years professor of government at Cornell University. He was recently confirmed, this I like, by the U.S. Senate as a member of the Board of Directors of the U.S. Institute for Peace. He, in addition to international law, he has a particular interest in national security law and early constitutional law. He teaches, for example, Mason's unique course entitled Constitutional Law, the Founding, which I really wish I could get to take. He holds a PhD from Harvard University, Department of Government, and graduated summa cum laude with a BA from Cornell University. With that introduction, let me begin, and I'll start with Steve at the far end. Steve, how realistic is the threat from other nation-state actors of a cyber attack? How likely is it from non-state actors like LulzSec or Anonymous to be a significant national security problem? Is, from a national security perspective, is the vulnerability theoretical or is it real?
Oh, it's absolutely real. I mean, I don't know how anybody now can deny the reality and the potential devastating effects of cyber attacks. I mean, they could take a couple of forms. They could be offensive attacks on U.S. government networks or critical infrastructure by foreign powers, perhaps as an adjunct to traditional military activity. If we're in hostilities, that's a loaded word these days, I guess, but if we're in hostilities with a foreign country, it's clear as a bell that in the 21st century, cyber is going to be a weapon that's used as an adjunct to hostilities. But also with LulzSec and WikiLeaks and other such occurrences, you see organized groups of private citizens, sometimes very small groups like LulzSec, just a handful, for political purposes, infiltrating U.S. systems, both public and private, and divulging that information in a way that can be very damaging to U.S. interests. And then you have just a vast amount of cyber crime where private individuals for financial gain are going after personal information to exploit that. At his confirmation hearing last year to be the head of Cyber Command, General Alexander noted that just the U.S. military networks experience, as he put it, hundreds of thousands of infiltrations every day. Now, most of those are just probes, but many of those, we believe, are coming from or under the auspices of foreign powers and foreign governments, because the value of the information they can get out of the systems is too high for them to ignore that possibility. So I think it's a very real threat.
A quick follow-up before opening up. You mentioned things like cyber crime. Do you think that the scope of cyber crime
is so great that it constitutes a national security threat, or is that just a significant, not to diminish it, but a significant economic threat without national security components?
I don't know if I'm in the best position to judge that, but the potential scope and scale of financial crime that involves infiltration, exfiltration of data, could be almost unlimited. And so at a certain point, a crime can pose a national security threat because it can have a devastating effect. I mean, something that affects networks on Wall Street, that's a national security issue. So something that involves massive amounts of data exploitation and release, public release, in ways that could devastate industries in the United States, that has national security implications for sure.
Gentlemen, others?
Sure.
I was looking at you.
We're working the kinks out of the system here, but it's a free fire zone, guys.
Steve's response does point out some of the problems we have when addressing cyber, and that is we're trying to take a new problem set and lay it on some old solutions that we have. And in some ways it's very difficult and not perhaps all that meaningful all the time to try to distinguish between whether something is crime, espionage, or action, or something undertaken by a nation state. If the result is the same in the United States, we still have to address the problem, no matter who's causing it. And we have these older constructs that we're dealing with now because we have, of course, internal security that deals with criminal threats like the police or the FBI. We have the military that generally deals with foreign threats. And then we have our intelligence agencies that deal with the espionage threat. And it's quite difficult to not only try to sort out what the threat is or where it comes from, but also decide which agency should deal with it. So that just creates another layer of trouble as we try to deal with the cyber threat, I think.
I'll layer on there, too, and go ahead and skewer my own profession before anyone else does. But kind of jumping on what you said, I don't think that we in the press have really developed a very good vernacular vocabulary for describing this. I mean, the term cyber war gets thrown around a lot and sort of becomes this catch-all for everything that we're talking about that's bad that happens to people on the internet. And I'm certain that I'm guilty of overusing the term as well. So, you know, we're sort of going through a bit of a learning process in this as well. There are certainly people who are writing about this who are not technically proficient and are trying to gather as much information from people like my panelists as to what is actually happening. But I think there's some caution that we need to exercise in that as well and not be so quick to call anything warfare or an act of war. The rhetoric can sort of, you know, get ahead of us a bit.
Yeah, so I'll skewer my current profession. There's a lot of surprisingly now extensive amount of legal literature which talks about the law of war in cyberspace, and it's really amazing. There hasn't been a actual cyber war, and still everyone's talking about what the rules are, which they imagine that we know in advance, because that's how we do war. First we agree on the rules, and then we fight it, and only law professors could think this. But, I mean, people should just focus on this when it is said that cyber weapons will be strategic weapons in the next few years. People are talking about, by the end of this decade, the cyber attack could be the main attack and deliver devastating consequences. Well, then you're saying strategic weapons, that's not machine guns, you know, that's not even explosives. Then you're saying it's equivalent to nuclear weapons. How well did we do figuring out the rules about nuclear weapons? Well, everybody was too panicked to actually try out nuclear weapons, but, you know, the future is bright and maybe Pakistan will have a chance to give some demonstration effects. What's scary about cyber is there's been this nuclear threshold. Even Pakistan has been a little bit nervous about using these weapons, the nuclear weapons. Plainly, a lot of countries are not nervous at all about at least trying out some small-level cyber attacks and see what happens. So it's not clear that there's a threshold to stop us from getting to the point where we actually experience cyber attacks on a strategic scale, where they're actually disabling. And that is a very, very scary thing, which I don't believe rules are in place to deal with, or perhaps rules couldn't deal with it.
It's interesting that you talk about the the salience of just the phrase cyber war. When I was, I'm writing a book, and when I was offering the title, I wanted to call it something like Securing Cyber Networks or something a little anodyne, and the publisher said, no, got to be cyber warfare or cyber war, because that'll sell the book. So we're calling it cyber warfare and something else on that. But so let's stay with that for a second, and let me turn to you, Gary. We're talking about war. We've talked about the laws of armed conflict already for a brief second. How does this fit? How does cyber fit into that paradigm? What would, from a military perspective, you view as a cyber attack? How would you distinguish it from a cyber intrusion? I know the military. I don't want you to front run the new policy that's going to come out in like 7 days. But to the extent that you can give us a sense of the thinking about what constitutes war in cyberspace, and whether and while you're at it, should America announce what it thinks, or is it better to have an idea but not announce it because we don't want to give people a sense of how we're going to respond?
Wow, it's a big.
Okay, well, break it up. Let's start with the first one. What's cyber war?
Right. We don't have an official stated policy defining cyber war. I'm sure probably folks in the room are interested in it. You might have read the international strategy that came out last month. And there is a reference in there to the way the United States would react in response to a cyber attack. It says we treat it like any other attack and respond in self-defense. But it doesn't go on to define what a cyber attack is, and that really is the problem here. I think the easiest solution when talking about what defines a cyber attack is just to try to match it up again with the law of war that we place now, which is anything that causes damage, destruction, death, or injury as an attack. That's generally the way we would look at the use of force or an armed attack in international law now. That's the easiest way. The problem is cyber is so unique and can create some interesting effects. For instance, some of the ones that are more difficult to quantify, well, they're not difficult to quantify, but they're difficult to lay against a standard, would be economic damage. Because at some point, economic damage to a nation, I think, impacts on its ability to project its strategic power and therefore becomes a military issue at some point. And it's difficult to quantify the elimination of ones and zeros in a bank with kinetic or physical damage that we generally look at when we talk about military attacks. So that makes it difficult. So we really haven't come out and put together a policy, and I don't know that anyone, any other government has either. A lot of people are saying things like, a lot of people, I'm sure, read the quotable quote in the newspaper about putting the missile down the smokestack of a nation that attacks us. But again, it doesn't really give us any clarity, because until we know what the attack is that would justify such a response, it doesn't really help.
Let me press on that and just ask you. You're the staff judge advocate to Cybercom, and you wake up tomorrow morning and the entire New York Stock Exchange is offline and down, and the trading records for last week are wiped. That's pretty extreme. It's unlikely, but,
Last week was a bad week.
I know, so we'd all be very happy to roll it back. But, this is actually the Tom Clancy scenario from one of his books. And General Alexander turns to you and says, what can I do? Can I respond in kind under the laws of armed conflict or not?
Right. In some ways, of course, it's difficult to say what would happen in exact circumstances.
Well, the president would tell you what to do, and you do it. That's the right answer.
Well, and in a way, and you're getting at exactly where I'm going, which is we can lay all the rules we want to on the table, but ultimately, in relations between nations and even in international law, because it mostly is the custom and practice of nations, what's going to constitute an attack is what the receiving or the recipient nation determines constitutes an attack at the time. So, under the circumstances, I would certainly assume that we would consider that an unfriendly act, and we may well choose or wish to respond to it. But it would be one thing to say, yes, we're justified in responding, but quite another to say, well, where and against whom do we respond? Because, of course, one of the issues with cyber is it's never been so easy to hide the source of an attack or an offensive action. And probably the one thing you can say is, for example, if the action against the stock exchange originated in Canada or wherever, Canada's probably the one place it didn't really originate. You can probably rule that one place out. It might have come from anywhere else in the world, but nobody is going to launch it exactly from where they're sitting. They're always going to launch it from some other country in between so they can't be found. So, right, after we did the forensics and we dug down deep enough after months and months and months of digging and found out who did it, I would imagine there would be a response. But at that point, as you know, the everybody's blood pressure's gone down and the diplomats have started to talk. And so really what I advised wouldn't really make much difference at that point anyway.
Others? See?
Yeah, well, on those issues like that, international law is not clear with respect to how you apply them in cyber. So, for example, is it a use of force? Is it an armed attack on the U.S.? Some cases are going to be clear if it's devastating damage, lots of loss of life or injury. It looks and feels like an armed attack, and pretty clear it would be. But the sort of circumstance you described, Paul, or lots of other great infinite variety of what could be viewed as a cyber attack, it's unclear. And I think it's largely a policy question for the president to decide and not a question for lawyers to sort of predetermine and cut off policy debate. But that's how customary international law, the laws and customs of war in these new areas develops. And we have to enable, we have to preserve that area of discretion for the president in the exercise of our national security interests to decide whether it's appropriate to respond. And from what I understand, there's apparently internal documents or views on a policy developing with regard to cyber warfare. And it sounds like from press reports that at this point the president is going in the right direction in terms of preserving the flexibility of the United States to respond in appropriate circumstances in appropriate ways where there is attribution to a foreign power. Now, maybe we'll get into it later. There are other aspects of what's been reported about this so far undisclosed presidential directive on the use of cyber warfare that I think, if accurate as reported in the press, I would take great issue with. And maybe we can get into that as well.
Let's hang a star on that one and come back to it maybe in the next question. Anybody else want to do this? No? Going once, going twice?
I'm not the lawyer, so I'm
okay. Well, then let me ask, Jeremy, you're the international lawyer. How does customary international law apply here? And more importantly, notwithstanding Steve's urging of the need for flexibility for the president, do you think that international law puts any sorts of responses out of bounds? Any types and forms of responses that we shouldn't engage in, either because of the de minimis nature of the attack or because the use of such tactics contravenes some international norm?
So let me correct you at the outset. I'm not the lawyer.
I know, you're not a lawyer. You're an international expert.
And I say it not just to boast, but sorry, that was a joke. I mean, nobody has a practice in the international law of cybersecurity. I mean, maybe some people get grants to, like, do studies, but this is not an active area of legal negotiation yet. So everything that everybody says is by analogy, and when there's no good analogy, it's just by fantasy or, anyway, conjecture. When people talk about customary international law, it's really important first to focus on this fact. Customary international law, as the name implies, used to be about custom, like what actually was done. Nobody knows what the custom in cyber war is because we haven't done a cyber war yet. So everybody is saying, oh, by analogy, you know, it would be like other kinds of wars. Well, maybe, maybe not. But then if you go one step back and say, okay, well, but the thing that they're using as the base from which they draw the analogies, the customary law of war, what's that based on? It's based on academic writings by lawyers in Switzerland and people commenting on academic. I mean, it's amazingly removed from actual custom. We have not fought a full-scale war against another great power since 1945. As you might remember, in 1945, we said atomic weapons, sure, we've got them, they are powerful, let's do it. And President Truman made a statement, we have used this weapon against Hiroshima, a military target. Okay, it's a military target, the president said so, great. That was the custom of 1945. Since then, we have sort of gone along with. We haven't actually ratified a number of important treaties, but we say that we embrace them sort of as custom. It's not a custom based on practice. It's a custom based on aspiration, rhetoric, some gestures toward practice on one side. And when you try to lay that onto a cyber war with China, if you're not confused, you're not paying attention.
Others?
Gag?
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, that's
undermine your important work in giving legal advice.
No, that's all right. I think it's it is a complicated area. Although, I think one of the things to point out, which we sort of danced around so far, is that because international law and the law of war in particular is based on custom and practice, one of the things we can't do, which a lot of people would like to do, academics and people in policy positions, is write all the rules before we start.
Right.
The custom of law developed from actually, or sorry, the custom of war developed from actually practicing war, from fighting wars. So there was no law of land warfare before we started having land warfare. We just did it a heck of a long time ago, so we've had the law and the custom in place for a long time. Sea warfare was later, but I'll point out that air warfare, we essentially going into, in fact, coming out of World War II, had very little customary law to govern air warfare. That mostly has developed in the since the latter part of the 20th century, and a lot of it came out of Desert Storm as recently as the early 1990s.
And all of it came out of non-strategic conflicts, right? Which were not conflicts which we viewed as we absolutely must win, otherwise our whole way of life will be doomed.
Right, not wars of survival.
Well, not wars on the scale of the Second World War, right? And we don't actually know what a war with China would be like, but probably it wouldn't be like Desert Storm.
I agree.
So your thesis, Jeremy, is that in a war of survival or a war of strategic consequence, the self-limiting rules that we imposed on ourselves in Iraq might go by the wayside, and we'd nuke Beijing.
But I think that's not necessarily a surprising conclusion. Because
what?
I think that all bets are off for any nation when they're facing extinction. So I don't think there are many nations that would stand on principle, the Melians aside.
So just if
so tell them all who the Melians are. I know, but
the Melians were a little island nation that faced a much greater Greek power and engaged in a dialogue, the Melian dialogue, a very famous debate about why they shouldn't be destroyed, but refused to yield. We know you can crush us if you want to, but we think you shouldn't crush us because of all these reasons, and ultimately we're crushed. But it was an interesting dialogue. Nobody's tried that since, as far as I know. Everybody else has just fought as hard as they could or yielded.
So just to put a point on this, war of survival maybe sounds so melodramatic that you think, like, oh, we're never going to be in a war of survival. I would just put this a different way, which is a war in which the enemy can do tremendous damage to us. And we have not fought a war since 1945 in which the enemy was capable of doing tremendous damage to us. Not China in the Korean War, Lord knows, not North Vietnam in the Vietnam War, not Saddam Hussein. But actually, within the next few years, and maybe already, China could do tremendous damage to us. Russia could do tremendous damage to us. If it's too melodramatic to say it's a war of survival, it's a war in which the stakes are extremely high. And you should just think about the analogy with nuclear war. Everybody refers to, oh, yes, air war, and we have these limits. We have these limits because we're assuming that we're talking about a rather limited war in which we don't really want to hurt too many people because none of our people are really going to be hurt anyway. But when we were thinking about nuclear war, we were constantly planning for mega death. I mean, we were constantly talking about devastating Soviet cities and having millions of casualties. If you can imagine, which you ought to if you're interested in this subject, yes, they shut down the New York Stock Exchange, they shut down the banking system. And they don't have to do it forever, they just have to do it for a month. And that'll have really devastating effects on our economy. And the anxiety, the sense of insecurity would be really extreme. I think when we contemplate how to respond, we're not going to be thinking about, of course, we don't want to hurt anyone because that would be wrong. We won't be thinking about it the way we thought about our interventions in, or we're thinking now about our intervention in Libya, where we don't want to hurt anyone, because they can't hurt us, right?
Shane?
Just an observation. I mean, it's not to minimize the importance of trying to codify this and put it within the law of war and understand what cyber war would look like, but I think that what might even pass for cyber war is about this much of what's actually going on today in cyberspace broadly. And we are engaged, as are other countries, in intelligence operations, presumably. I presume none of which are really governed by the laws of war. They're governed by, you know, different sections of our laws. It's probably convenient to keep things flexible, because then that doesn't limit what we might already be doing in that area. So, I mean, war, it's important to think about war as a potential outcome of all of this. But I dare say the vast majority of what we're doing now falls under the banner of good old-fashioned intelligence operations.
Can I just a quick point? I mean,
the more you guys talk, the less I have to ask questions.
So, I totally agree with that, and it's important to say, and it's important to remember. Is it reassuring or is it unnerving? I mean, think about the nuclear analogy. The last time people were talking about strategic weapons, just one attack would determine the outcome of the war. The reassuring thing about nuclear weapons is people didn't, like, try them out on a small scale, fool around with them, just do a test, see, probe with them. I mean, everybody had the sense of, if you cross that threshold, it could be the end of the world. What's scary to me about cyber, let's say, conflict, if you don't like war, is fooling around. We could fool around a little more. There's hundreds of thousands of, you know, jabs, probes, mm-hmm. tests. And it's not obvious where the line is that we say, whoa, you have now crossed the threshold, and we are going to shut down the World Wide Web throughout the whole wide world. This to me suggests that we are in danger of stumbling into something, more danger of stumbling into something than we used to be, because we're constantly, mm-hmm. you can escalate easily.
Yeah. I don't know if Jeremy was intending to suggest this. I think really what you're saying is that there will be wars that are where the threat is so great that we are likely to use these cyber weapons in full glory, or whatever, and other countries are too. But I don't think you're suggesting that we should view cyber warfare and cyber weapons like nuclear weapons, because they're not. I mean, nuclear weapons are cataclysmic in their effect and rarely used. I mean, they've only been used, as you suggest, very few times. And a regime has developed.
Twice.
Yes, and a regime has developed against their use almost entirely. Whereas cyber warfare is used today, and it's used by nation states all the time. And they're using it not just for military gain, but also for espionage purposes. And there's a full spectrum of potential activities that could be characterized as cyber warfare or adjuncts to military interests. And so my point is the rules are unclear, and we shouldn't create a regime in advance crafted by lawyers that prevents the potential use of these capabilities in ways that the president, as a policy matter, might determine will appropriately advance U.S. national security interests. And again, I want to get at some point, Paul, to a couple of aspects.
I guarantee we're going to get there, but I'm going to pivot slightly here and obviously and ask Shane this question. And it's not on your list, so it's a new question. We talked about the questions.
It's about guns.
No. Yeah. Obviously, these are policies of great consequence, and how we respond and what we think our responses should be are of great importance. And yet, much of what of this discussion happens behind closed doors, often quite reasonably, because much of what we need to talk about is classified in one way or another. On the other hand, that excludes the public from the discussion. Talk to me a little bit about how you try and value the transparency versus secrecy values, and more particularly, how that plays out in the context of trying to develop a public understanding of cyber policy.
Well, I mean, no surprise I'm going to come down on the side of more information being disclosed.
Okay, it was a softball, right?
Yeah, so, yes, keep everything secret. No. I think you hit upon something there, and I'd even go one step further. I mean, this is the secrecy around this issue, certainly to some degree, and perhaps to an understandable degree, limits public understanding of the issues. I think it also limits understanding within the government among the stakeholders of the issues. I mean, one of the constant complaints that I hear, and I'm sure other reporters do as well, is that even within the government, it's difficult to have discussions about this because things are tightly held and compartmentalized. It certainly does not facilitate a free flow of ideas in exchange between the private sector and the government when all of this is shrouded in secrecy. We're seeing a lot more policies become public, and it's a lot less secret than it was a few years ago. And the more the companies like Google come out and disclose the things that have been happening to them, the more everyone gets a little more comfortable with saying, yes, it's happening, it's real, we should, you know, bring this to the table. Of course. I mean, the more that you wrap this stuff up and put it behind a veil, the harder it is to understand. And I think there's a sort of an inverse risk, which is that there's the chance of just so severely overhyping it that the public just tunes out. And I think that you may be seeing even a little bit of this cyber fatigue growing in the next year or so. Until something really dramatic happens, like a city experiences a blackout or a dam opens up, you know, the Die Hard 4 scenario or whatever, I'm not so sure that people really get this. And to the extent that the government can't really come out and talk about it so freely, that doesn't really help public understanding either. All that said, I mean, the reason that we know so much about what we know is because people are leaking to people like me. You know, they are selectively informing the public, you know, bit by bit, and then companies like Google are coming forward and I think sort of, you know, in a game-changing way, kind of throwing radical transparency on this. But it's all going to get out. I mean, this is not going to be a discussion that just continues to go on behind closed doors. Eventually, this is going to become very public. And to the extent that there are groups, vigilante groups like LulzSec out there right now trying to, you know, crack open the vaults and expose information and negotiations that are going on, you know, somebody could hack into, you know, the documentation on a lot of these agreements and expose what's going on within the government and with the private sector that way. I mean, it's just, it's impossible that this is going to stay a quiet discussion.
Gary, is that a big change? I mean, you know, in the past, when Army doctrine on rules of engagement in Afghanistan were developed, they weren't quite so much the focus of public discussion. How does the fact that a lot of people, you know, 80 people in this room and 80 million outside are focused on what you do, how does it affect, does it affect the choices that you can make? Does it limit your choices?
I'm not sure that it limits the choices we can make, but obviously it makes it challenging to have the, it does make it challenging to have the open discussions because there is a lot of compartmentalization within the government and our various security classifications and particularly with the specific techniques and tools that the folks use in some of our activities. Those are, a lot of those are, they don't last forever. And just like you read about, you know, with your home computer, some there might be some vulnerabilities there that are pretty easily fixed if somebody knew it existed. So the fact that we or somebody else in the United States government might be using that for in the national interest means that we don't really want to tell everybody what it is so they can, the bad guys can go fix that vulnerability. But there is a balance, and I think there's a continuing balance because of course, there are only a few operating systems, for example, and web browsers, for example, across the planet. There really aren't that many, and a vulnerability in a system in some other country is likely to be a vulnerability on systems in the United States. So there's a balance in sharing that with folks so they can protect themselves in the United States and using it in the national interest outside the United States. So that does make it difficult. So in that regard, I guess it does sort of limit our choices to some extent.
I think it is worth just reminding people, though, I think, I mean, just in the past 2 years, you have seen so much more light shed on this area than there was 2 years ago. I mean, it is, and it's rapidly. I mean, you're reading all the time stories about not just these incidents and these events, but just in the past week, we've learned that, you know, because Deputy Secretary Lynn disclosed it, that the government is working very closely with Internet service providers now and providing them with threat signature information so that they can turn around and block threats against the defense industrial base. I mean, that's the kind of comment that I dare say a year ago no one ever would have acknowledged in public. And now it's you have one of the most senior people in the government announcing that this is policy.
Well, that's actually a good transition. I promise we're coming to your question, even if it's the last one. But I'll ask you a different question this time, right, Steve, which is who's responsible for protecting the internet? What Shane has just talked about is the reality that a large fraction of what happens that is related to national security involves private sector activity, private networks, the defense industrial base, or we were talking about the stock market or the electric grid. You know, so who should be responsible? Should the government take direct responsibility for protecting the private sector, or should the civilian networks do it themselves? And more importantly, what are the legal limitations relating to the government's engagement with that network, with the private sector networks, and how should those be kind of brought forward and made into policy?
Well, there are actual legal limitations, and then there are those limitations we impose on ourselves as a policy matter. I think the answers to all the questions you raised have not been fully settled as a policy matter yet. But certain things we know. The federal government is responsible, and we put it in the hands for the civilian non-classified or unclassified networks in the hands of the Secretary of Homeland Security for protecting the integrity of its own networks that it uses. We've also, by statute, at least in general terms, assigned to the Department of Homeland Security the responsibility for at least organizing a federal effort to protect what we call critical infrastructure, which would include the network assets of certain private sector industries that are critical to our national security, and they could include electrical power grids, telecommunications networks. There's a range, but they're relevant to our defense industrial base as a general matter. Those authorities and the way they're going to be implemented haven't really been fleshed out in very concrete terms yet. We're still sort of feeling our way through that, and I think the policy you referenced heard about recently, developed by the administration, that would involve the sharing of signature information from Cyber Command and NSA with private ISPs that would be involved in searching data, screening data that's flowing into the networks of defense contractors, critical infrastructure operators, et cetera. I think there's a wide area of debate whether that's sufficient. For example, as I understand it, a limitation that we're imposing on ourselves is that none of the new information about new signatures that are identified or threats that private ISP identifies in screening that data can be shared with the federal government. Well, that seems pretty self-defeating. So the question is, how can we ensure that the federal government takes the steps that are appropriate and necessary to protect at least critical infrastructure networks and gets that information in a real-time basis so the system can learn about new threats, so we can develop new signatures and stop the next attack from coming in? And one way that that's been done is through the Einstein system that the federal government operates for its own networks, which involves a system that's based on consent. And so all the users of the network have to sign up and consent to having all their communications searched, so go in and out of the network over the Internet. And that's what the federal government is setting up. It's not in place yet, but setting up for its own networks. And that has to develop technologically so we actually have the ability in real time to stop threats and not just detect them as they're coming through. But then I think that kind of scheme can be extended to at least certain intranets or closed network systems for critical infrastructure operators, including defense contractors and private companies that are in that, where all the users of the network actually consent, have to sign user agreements when they're signing on to the network. And those are imposed through agreements or perhaps by regulation or, if necessary, by statute on those critical infrastructure operators. But I don't think that kind of scheme can be extended to the general public Internet. And a lot of people have talked about the threat to the public Internet as a national security threat. Richard Clark, in his book, Cybersecurity, recently suggested we need to do something there. And there, I really don't see a way to put in place that kind of firewall system that involves the federal government in an active way in screening the data. I just don't think policymakers will abide that, and I don't think the public will.
I was actually just going to ask that question. Not, can't do it because it's technologically infeasible or because it's illegal or because it's unpalatable.
Well, the only way I could conceive of it being done legally is, and I'm not sure this would pass constitutional muster, it would have to be by statute, and perhaps you could require a federal license for all ISPs that operate backbone networks on the Internet. And as a condition of the license, you could require that they get user consents from all of their users on their networks to government screening or screening that's interactive with the government. Because if it's not interactive with the government, if it's just done for the integrity of the network by private operators and can't be shared with the government, I don't think that's a sufficient solution for protection purposes. But I think there's a real question whether that would be constitutional. But
let me channel people who I'm not normally on the side of and pretend I'm Mark Rotenberg out there and say, I mean, what privacy and civil liberties threats do you see in a program, even the limited one of a consent-based program that screens private sector traffic, both Fourth Amendment concerns and more fundamental privacy and civil liberties concerns?
Talking about private sector traffic over the general public Internet?
Or even private sector, I mean, you're talking about screening, say, the defense industrial base, say, in an Internet system.
Right.
Right, and we can assume that most of the traffic going into Lockheed Martin or Raytheon today is governmentally related, but a significant fraction of it is going to be the wife checking in with the husband about bringing home bread, or
But that's true for federal workers as well, and that those issues were addressed. There's a big opinion, legal opinion. I actually happen to
you wrote sign. It. I know. This is why I gave you the
and,
question.
And the president's administration chose to make it all public, so they published it. And it goes into in great detail those issues because and says that there is a legal basis. You can give one user can give consent, and even an outsider who's communicating with that user doesn't have a privacy interest in the protection of that. The message once it's delivered to the person.
So let me press on that. Since the defense industrial base lives off of federal contracts, the federal government, in your judgment, could contractually require members of the defense industrial base to join the intranet as a condition of getting a federal contract, which they all would do because Raytheon doesn't want to give up its contracts or I don't want to pick
on
any
particular. It'd be pretty simple. So, for example, with a Raytheon, you wouldn't have to do it necessarily for the whole company, but if you're working on a classified project or a contract for the military or what have you, you could require as a condition that everybody working on that project be on an intranet and sign user consents to have all of the communications that flow over that network screened. And it could be screened by the Einstein system under contract with the federal government. So I think that could be done, and I think that would resolve issues under statutes that protect privacy that go beyond the Fourth Amendment because they all have consent exceptions in there. But I don't think, as a practical and probably as a legal matter, you could extend that kind of model to screening of the entire public Internet. And I just don't think it's going to happen, and I think one reason it's not going to happen is because we have a culture on the Internet that supports the explosion of e-commerce in this country that would be inconsistent with that kind of model. And I think the use of the Internet, there'd be a revolt by users of the Internet, and use of the Internet and e-commerce generally would be threatened. And so I don't think Congress is going to allow something like that to happen.
Shane?
Yeah, I think
this was my next question. What are the privacy and civil liberties concerns?
Yeah. What privacy?
Yeah.
To piggyback on what you're saying, I mean, there's also something short of monitoring the entire Internet, which I agree would be revolutionary, and you would see people revolt about that, and there would be enormous policy debates. But, you know, if we're sort of speaking about this hypothetically, but it's at least my understanding with the defense industrial base, if they've not been told you have to do this or you're not going to be working with the government, I think the implication is pretty strong that that is the case. So let's just say, for sake of argument, that the DIB as a pilot program is real life, it's working. I do think that the next place that the government would go with that would be critical infrastructure and protecting electrical grids. They are regulated. It doesn't seem to me that it would be that much of a leap then in a year or two you know, perhaps there's some big event that's a seismic thing that gets everyone's attention and scares people, that then you say, well, you know what, the financial sector is also seems like a pretty critical infrastructure. As soon as you start slapping that label, CI, onto everything, there becomes a very compelling reason for the government to get involved at, in some way, at some level. And I think that you could create sort of a patchwork of systems where there are, you know, sort of zones of the internet that are more monitored than others. And you would just have to, as a user of it, I guess you would have to consent to that, perhaps, if your bank decided they were going to change their terms of service and say, hey, look, we're a critical infrastructure. You know, suspicious activity reports go on right now. Transactions are monitored to some degree in the system. I mean, there is precedent for all of this. And I think that's sort of that there will be, I predict there will be an incremental approach that we will get to the point where significant portions of online activity are screened and monitored by the government in some way, working with the private sector. And the details of that yet to be determined. That will become reality, I think.
I think it's good to remind ourselves that there are more than two things that we're concerned about. It isn't just security versus privacy. On the security side, you don't want to give people the illusion that the government's on the job. You're safe. Right? I remember seeing this figure that there are more people employed in private security than in public police forces, which at first sounds impossible, and then you think about how many shopping malls, university schools, buildings have people who they hire who aren't police to supplement police because they know you can't really rely on police. We wouldn't want to give the signal to the private sector that the government will protect you because it probably won't. So they should all be thinking hard about what they can do to protect themselves. And I think that's another trade-off in this. And then there's a, we should remind ourselves that part of the excitement of the internet is that it actually is worldwide. That's why they used to call it the World Wide Web. And a lot of countries want to screen what their own people can receive, and it is our official policy for good reasons to push back on that and say, no, we want this to be an open system. We want this to be an open system. It's kind of hard to tell, you know, Egypt, let alone China, that they should promote openness when we are closing off more and more or putting more and more of it under surveillance. And part of openness is reassuring people that they can speak kind of confidently and openly and not be monitored by the security services, which again is hard for us to promise if we're actually doing that. So there are a lot of trade-offs in this.
Okay. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. If you want to,
I think there are a couple of points that people often forget when they talk about this privacy concern. First of all, we have talked in sort of generic terms about providing security, and one of the things to remember is as we provide security with systems that are monitoring threats coming in, we're protecting ourselves against known threats. So obviously, we can't, if we don't know what to look for, we're not looking for it. So whatever threats that we haven't figured out yet are still going to get past whatever system we put up unless we're stopping everything, which, of course, shuts down the Internet. So there are always going to be threats to get through. I don't know what percentage that is, but it's a significant percentage because you have a lot of smart people out there making money, figuring out ways to penetrate people's systems and get around the smart people who are trying to stop them from penetrating systems. And in cyber, I think we've all concluded that the offense has the advantage, which is not the norm in a lot of military activities anyway. Usually defense has the advantage, but not in this case. So the other thing is, I don't know how much any of you have studied what things look like in the Internet and how the Internet works, but it is absolutely, first of all, it's mind-boggling the way it works, but it's also completely different than anything else you've ever worked with, and it's this incredible machine that's sort of self-healing and sends things all over the planet that you wouldn't expect and somehow puts it all back together in a fraction of a second so that somebody on the other end of the wire can read it. But the part that I want to get at is any like an email that you might send that might have something private in it is broken up into packets that's sent across the Internet in various ways. Many of the threats that are going to come in, they have nothing to do with the text of your email. The text of your email is irrelevant. What they want to look at essentially is analogous to the address that you write on the outside of a letter that you might mail. That address, the header information and the destination and the origin information oftentimes is very interesting to look at when we're looking for threats. So I don't know whether people understand when we talk about the privacy and what we look at for security. I don't know that they understand that we're looking at the outside of the envelope for much of this. We can get a lot of goodness out of just looking at the outside of the envelope, and I'm not sure that's widely understood.
A question, and I'm not sure who's going who I'm going to ask to answer this, but I'll put it out there. We've leapt, quite quickly here to the idea of government activity helping the private sector with its security. Is anybody concerned that the government, as an actor, is insufficiently nimble to actually achieve this, and that in fact private sector actors with appropriate economic incentives are much more well-suited to doing this in some ways? I mean, think of it. We live in a world where the notice and comment rulemaking process is 18 to 36 months on a good day, and longer on a bad day, using systems that are still trying to resolve payouts from 9/11, which was 10 years ago, administratively. Is government engagement of that active a sort the right model, or is it more of an information sharing idea, which is where we are now with the DIB pilot?
Well, let me say, government is never nimble enough, particularly
right.
when you're talking about cyber developments, internet, the internet world. Of course, private network operators, private ISPs, private security companies are going to always be ahead of the government in terms of developing new technologies and abilities to protect their own networks, and we should encourage that to happen as much as possible. But government is going to be a necessary actor in helping to organize national policy for the protection of critical networks, and that's only because it's necessary. But it is necessary because every private operator of a network only sees out to the borders of that network and can't affect things that happen beyond that. And the threats that come in from beyond the border of the network might be insurmountable for that operator. So it's got to be a cooperative effort.
Well,
I was going to say, there's also the people who sit in your command also have something the private sector doesn't, which is the technical skill and, frankly, the legal authority to go out and conduct espionage, to find out who is doing this, to find where these threats are coming from. I mean, there's a lot of information that the government can provide, I think, that companies cannot, at least legally, go out and get themselves. And I know from talking to a lot of companies, there are all kinds of things that they would like to know about the threats against them, and they expect that the government probably is in the best position to tell them what those threats are. So, I mean, it seems to me that, to answer your question, you don't necessarily have to be nimble to be able to get good information. And if the government has a lot of information, I suspect that there are companies that would like to share in it. And that has not necessarily always been a very a very forthcoming relationship in the past. Let's put it that way.
I just mention another aspect of this. Of course, you want to encourage private initiative. Of course, you want to encourage private inventiveness. Of course, you want to encourage private investment. But the government wants to know about it. And the government wants to get the benefits of it. And I think there are two complications. One is, if you give information to the government about what you are doing, can you rely on the government to maintain confidentiality? Which, I mean, that's real complicated. Particularly, there's litigation, there's other things, there are leaks. And then there's the question, will you have some kind of legal liability or legal exposure, and can you rely on the government to either defend you if there's a controversy down the road, or to give you clear guidance about what you can and can't do? So the government gets drawn into this even apart from what it's supposed to be doing in the name of security itself. The private sector does depend on clear rules and clear guidance, and my understanding is they don't get as much of that as they'd like.
So I got two more quick questions, and then we'll go to you. And this brief one for you, Jeremy. You mentioned the international nature of this, and we've been focusing here mostly on America and American concerns. Some people, commentators, foreign governments, say that we need an international treaty to, kind of the Geneva Conventions of cyberspace. Good idea, bad idea, what would it look like?
It's an inevitable idea because you want to coordinate, so why not have a treaty? It's very, very difficult to do, and although I do see the appeal of it, I'm very wary of it. Two facts that people should remind themselves of whenever they hear talk about, yes, we need a cyber understanding, cyber security treaty. The Russians have been pushing for this since the 1990s because surely a big part of this is they've noticed that, wow, they're so far ahead of us in America, they need to be stopped. Let's have a treaty. They've, in the same period of 20 years, they've been saying we should have a treaty to limit missile defense. Yeah, sure, because we could do it, and they don't think they can do it. So, I mean, you have to worry that the treaty will be used by hostile powers to limit us. And the other thing you have to worry about is it would be hard to keep it focused on the few things that we care most about. What China keeps saying is we need to have international agreements so that people stop sending subversive information into China. And that is half the countries in the world want curbs on subversive information on the internet. Also pornography, also insults to religion, also other things they don't like. So you just try and imagine what the international negotiation would be like, and very likely we would lose control of it, and then we'd say after promoting this conference, but we can't sign the treaty because it didn't come out right. So I'm very, very aware of this. But I would like to mention one part of this that I think is really, really important. We're going to have problems with stuff that is rooted not through China, as was said earlier, but comes from Canada, or worse, because I do think Canada at this point will cooperate with us, but it comes from Belgium. It comes from one of those little European countries whose overriding national defense strategy is to duck and to say, I'm sorry, we're just out of this. We would really, really like for them to cooperate with us when we're trying to trace where did this come from and what's it about. And they can say, well, just pass through. It's nothing to – you can't, right? And I think it would be helpful to get some understandings about what we can expect from third parties when we're trying to trace networks. And I think the history of customary international law or even Hague conventions from 1907 on neutrality are not very helpful in figuring out what we should or shouldn't allow ourselves to do in dealing with so-called neutrals or third parties.
Steve? Waving
all
your
right,
finger.
I see my opportunity. I'm going to jump in.
Yeah, okay. The next question was going to be, what don't you like about the president's policy?
Well,
so
I'm gonna,
if it's
gonna
in this
right
realm,
to that,
speak
so
to it.
I'm not going to wait.
It was the Belgium question, which you were
but I'm
going to
make
for.
One point first. On the treaty thing, I think that my view, the answer to the question, should we promote a treaty on cyber warfare at the present time, is absolutely not. Typically, treaties under laws of war are codifying practices that are well developed and largely where there's a large measure of consensus, and that, as we've discussed, is not at all the case with respect to the use of cyber weapons and cyber warfare. And I don't think it's in the U.S. interest to preclude or preempt how things might develop. I think we want to develop it as a policy matter for the United States, and how we choose to act will have a large measure in defining what the customs of war, cyber warfare, are. And I think that's the way we should want it to develop. And my criticism of the so far secret policy of the administration on cyber warfare that's been leaked probably by the White House to the press but hasn't actually been disclosed, if as reported, one aspect of it includes a prohibition on cyber attack, the U.S. undertaking a cyber attack, for example, on a website that's located on a server in a second country, and directing that cyber attack through a third country. Presumably, I mean, the reports are anyway in the press, who knows if they're accurate, are that that's prohibited under the president's directive. Well, that's absurd if that's the case, I think, because the internet knows no borders and the internet is going to flow, as the colonel described, packets flow all over the place. So that is basically a prohibition on the military attacking a website in a second country where it's where it's necessary in support of a military action. So the principle that's presumably the legal principle that's presumably underlying that is one of neutrality. Again, I think there's a wide area for the president and our national security policymakers to determine that an action that involves cyber communication going through a third country is not infringing the neutrality of that country in the way that the laws and customs of war are contemplating for the prohibition on the violation of neutrality. So what I actually suspect the president's directive probably says is don't do that unless I approve it. Or don't do it unless I approve it if it involves the following 10 countries, which are basically our major Western allies, for example. I can't believe there would actually be some general prohibition. But that's the kind of rule you might well get if you get a bunch of lawyers from the State Department or the Justice Department to sit down and make up the rules. And that's what would happen if we set upon negotiating some treaty. You're going to get lawyers with aspirations as to what they think the rules should be in this new regime, deciding it in a way that limits unnecessarily the national security flexibility of the United States.
But you agree that we might have understandings with other countries that aren't universal international treaty law.
Sure.
And having those kind of understandings probably would make it easier for Gary Brown to say, sure, we can do it. We have an understanding.
Sure.
Well, I'm going to offer Gary the opportunity to comment, but not mandate it, because I don't know if this is something he's not.
I can't really speak to the to the policy that they've reported in the paper, but I will say it does point up the problem of geographic ambiguity very well, and that is really when you hit the send button on whatever it is, you have no idea where it's going when it leaves your computer, and so it would be certainly problematic to have rules on where packets go.
Okay. Well, that's sort of comforting. Any last words on any of the topics here before I open up to questions from the audience?
I'll just make one quick observation.
Good. You looked like you were going
to.
Yeah.
You reminded me of something that's worth noting when you talked about the Russians wanting to, you know, really advocating for a treaty because they would love to stop the U.S. from developing its offensive capabilities. As scared as we are about things that are going on and emanating from China, I promise you the Chinese are more scared of us and what our capabilities are. I mean, it's worth noting that we have some amount of leverage, I suppose, in this whole game, which is that, you know, we are not victims here. We are very good at doing a lot of these things, and I think a lot of countries are afraid of us.
I think that is true. I'm not sure it's reassuring. And I mean,
you keep wanting to be reassured.
Well, I mean, yes, it is a scary world. I mean, when people first started thinking about nuclear strategy, one of the first things they focused on was the inherent instability of a world in which the first strike could disable the capacity to respond. So there might be this use it or lose it syndrome, right? And that's precisely what happens when you don't have enough nuclear missiles to survive a first strike. It's the weaker power that is more likely to feel that urgency to strike first. If you tell me China's not as far ahead as we are, that maybe says China feels they have to get in the first blow. Right? It's not that, oh, well, they'll be intimidated. They may actually feel the reverse, that they have to. And this is all very, very hard to think about. It's all very hard to think
exciting.
About.
Steve, we got to get to the questions. One last comment.
Point on the treaty point. A lot of nations in this world that advocate treaties, particularly in the law of war area, where they have absolutely no intention of abiding by the limitations in the treaty because they don't really see penalties under international law for violating the treaty, whereas they know that one thing that marks the United States is actually we take treaties very seriously. You know, there may be disagreements about the meaning and application of treaties, but there's a lot of debate, there's a lot of effort, there's a lot of lawyering on keeping policymakers within the bounds of treaties and abiding by our international obligations. So we're at a relative disadvantage when we sign up to a treaty with countries that don't really respect the limitations in the treaty.